is there a black pen?
Yeah.
Thank you.
One of these is a new
good.
One.
Okay. So we have a very tough chairwoman today, so I'm taking the time by my running clock. So, okay. So yesterday, a couple of you came to me and asked what's the point of constructing semi-classical states which are not gauge invariant, which are not solutions of the constraints. As I said in the very beginning, we don't want them to be solutions of the constraints, because if they were, so if all the constraints applied to these coherent states would be equal to zero, then we couldn't test these constraints in the sense that we want to check that psi, C psi hat, is labeled by some point in the classical phase space, A naught and E naught. A naught, E naught, is actually the same thing as the classical function plus H bar corrections, and that psi of A naught, E naught, psi squared, psi of E naught, E naught, minus the classical squared is order h bar, which means that the fluctuations in these states are also small. So this, we want these coherent states have no physical meaning. Their only purpose is to check whether we have quantized things in appropriately. So today I'm going to start a new topic. Maybe the topic, it's the benchmark of canonical quantum gravity since the seminal papers of de Witt have appeared in 1967. Everything that we have done so far is peanuts compared to what I'm going to do today. Or in German, jetzt geht's ans Eingemachte. Okay, so the topic is Hamiltonian constraint. And related to this is master constraint program. And let us start with something that we know already, which was the classical algebra of constraints. So we assume to have solved the Gauss constraint already by group averaging, which was leading to the spin networks with their gauge invariant intertwiners, as described by Laurent. So the only constraints left are the spatial diffeomorphism constraint, which I smear here with some shift vector fields. D3x, Na, Ca, sigma, and C of n, the Hamiltonian constraint, D3x, N, C. And these constraints, this mere constraint, they were obeying this, this Dirac algebra, C of n, C of n prime, equal to 16 pi j c of ln n prime c of n. So these were the classical constraints and their Poisson algebra. Now, before going into the quantum theory, we can read off from these three lines of equations already that there are going to be severe problems with the Hamiltonian constraint. Number one, if you look at the third line here, then we see that we are not in the situation that we needed in order to apply group averaging in order to solve the constraint, because the right-hand side is a constraint, but it depends on this phase space function, Q. So these are not structure constants as we needed in order to apply group averaging. These are structure functions. The constraints do not form a Lie algebra. Group averaging does not apply. That's the first thing, which can be said like group averaging problems. The second thing is that what we observe here is that we are talking here in the first two lines about the infinitesimal generators of spatial diffeomorphisms. Now, it is not difficult to see that the quantum analogs of these guys doesn't exist. Why is that the case? Consider, as we did a couple of lectures ago, consider a one-parameter family of diffeomorphisms. T goes to phi u of t, where u is some vector field on the manifold. And consider the corresponding operators u of phi u t. So now we have a family of unitary operators. And then we consider things like this. So we have a spin network function T gamma with some intertwiner and some label J and I. And we consider these guys phi u T T gamma J and I. Now let's suppose that the following is the case, that the vector field has support in some region where the graph gamma is actually located, let's say like this. Then it will be the case that for each value of t, the graph gamma will be shifted by this diffeomorphism. So in other words, it will be the case that phi u of t of gamma is different from gamma for all t. But this means that these states are, this is a spin network state, because u of phi acts on a spin network state t gamma j I just by shifting the graph phi of gamma and I. So I can work this out here. But we said that spin network states are provide an orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. Therefore, this is equal to 0 for all t bigger than 0. On the other hand, this is not the same as t gamma j and I, which is equal to 1 because the spin network states are normalized. So what this means, what mathematicians say then, is that the one parameter subgroups of the diffeomorphisms groups are not implemented weakly continuously. Actually, I may write this here. So one parameter subgroups of diff sigma do not act weakly continuously. But it's precisely this what you need. Weak continuity is precisely what you need in order to prove that there is a generator of a unitary subgroup. And this is known as Stone's theorem. Stone's theorem. There exists no self-adjoint generator of u phi u t for any u, for any vector field u. In particular, not for this vector field that I've chosen here, let's say n vector or n vector here. In other words, there exists no infinitesimal diffeo operators do not exist. Now, this is going to cause problems because you want to implement these relations, these algebraical relations, as commutators, not as Poisson brackets in the quantum theory. In fact, it's not so bad for these two relations because there's an exponentiated, if you want, analog of them. But it's, again, bad for this relation because of this structure functions. You cannot exponentiate this one. That doesn't work. Therefore, you will get problems with the right-hand side of this equation. So one could say that to conclude this discussion, the closure of the algebra in the third relation is prohibited by the non-existence of the Lie algebra of diff sigma, or maybe this is red, but writing non-existence of generators of Lie diff sigma as operators on our Hilbert space. So, the only thing you need to know about then, therefore, is here, in order to understand these obstacles, is these two properties, namely, first of all, this weak discontinuity of the diffeomorphism group, which, by the way, is due to the fact that the Hilbert space is non-separable. It has not a countable basis, because the spin networks are labeled by graphs, and there are an uncountably infinite number of graphs, and all the spin network states on different graphs are orthogonal to each other. And the second thing is that this Lie algebra, this is not a Lie algebra. So how can we go about this? Possible solutions. The second problem could be avoided if one changes the Hilbert space. If you get a separable Hilbert space in which these diffeos do act weakly continuously. So change the representation. Change the representation. But then you are colliding with the uniqueness theory. Because if you insist that you have diffeo invariants, if you insist that you want to talk about holonomies and electric fluxes, like we argued that we want very much because we have nice properties, then you have a clash with the uniqueness theorem. A second possibility that we are going to follow is change the algebra of constraints. By this I mean I want to write down an alternative set of algebra constraints which are equivalent to those constraints, but which have an algebra which doesn't face these problems. And this leads to the so-called master constraint. So the idea is the following. We define the following thing. So this is the square of the Hamiltonian constraint divided by the determinant of the spatial metric. So what the properties of these functions are as follows. Number one, m equal to 0 is equivalent to c of x equal to 0 for all x. This is because this is a positive function, and in order that it vanishes, the integrand has to vanish. Here I'm assuming, as always, that at least the fields are continuous, of course. So this means that M encodes the same constraint surface as all these Hamiltonian constraints did. The second very important thing is that M is spatially diffeomorphism invariant. How does one see this? Well, it follows from this relation, that C, the Hamiltonian constraint, is a scalar density of weight 1. And so is the metric. So this whole object is a scalar density of weight 1. And weight 1 scalar densities are nice volume functions. So this is a well-defined diffeomorphism invariant object. The third property of this master constraint is also very important, because remember that the constraints always had two functions. At least first-class constraints always had two functions or features which were equally important. On the one hand, they define the constraint hypersurface. On the other hand, they generate gauge motions within the constraint hypersurface. And they enabled us to identify physically equivalent points. In particular, we wanted to have the invariant points, which are the Dirac observables. So Dirac observables can be encoded by the following equation. Dirac observables F, say, F, F, M, when M equal to 0, which is the constraint hypersurface, is equal to 0. In order to see this, we just need to calculate this, what this means. It means the following. Using the fact that I'm on the constraint hypersurface, you can write this as d3x 1 over that q f comma c of x squared. There's another term which involves the double Poisson bracket between f and cx times cx, and there's another term which involves the Poisson bracket with that q, but since I'm on the constraint hypersurface, these two terms vanish. So if this is equal to 0, then we have to have f comma c of x is equal to 0 for all x. So this is exactly the definition of a Dirac observer. The fourth point here is that the Lie algebra of spatial diffeomorphisms and this master constraint is now extremely simple. So we keep the first relation, C of n, comma C of n prime, is equal to 16 pi g. It's the first relation. The second relation is, since M is diffeomorphous invariant, we want, or we have, and trivially we have M with M is equal to zero because the Poisson bracket is an anti-symmetric object. So you can, yes? Same theory. Classical.
How come the one theory is pathological, another is not?
What do you mean by pathological?
Well, I mean, you just listed a moment ago, you just listed the number of pathologies
No. I'm using a different classically equivalent starting point, which will prove to be non-pathological in the quantum theory. It's like using bad coordinates in differential geometry. In the one case, you end up with nonsense. In the other case, you end up with something useful. The choice of coordinates in quantum theory constraints in this case, is especially sensitive. I mean, in one case, you end up with something you can't even quantize, and sometimes you go until the very end.
That's right, but this I would call different theory.
Classically, it's the same. I just showed it to you.
But quantum mechanics is different.
Yeah, one case doesn't even
exist. It doesn't exist, but other case it does.
Yeah, so quantum theory is not derivable from the classical theory.
Right.
So
we just define your quantum theory by using this algebra and not that.
That's right, yeah. So now these two obstacles that we had before are gone. I mean,
sorry. So maybe at the end we could say that if we could pass the problems that you just numbered with the algebra that you have behind you, and if we could pass them, and we get a quantum theory, and on the other hand we get a quantum theory using these master constraints, the only way to choose which is the right one. Experiment.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
So, as you can see from this, this now classically defines a very nice Lie algebra, and therefore we will have a chance to solve the constraints by rigging map techniques. What about the second problem, the non-existence of diffeomorphisms in our representation, infinitesimal diffeomorphisms in our representation? Well, instead of writing these things here, I can talk about these automorphisms that we had. And these were actually the ones that we quantized. So classically, it is also equivalent to say that we want to have an implementation of diffeomorphisms by automorphisms such that they form a group. And that M is invariant. And in the quantum theory, this translates into that we want to have that our unitary operators labeled by diffeomorphisms do form a group. And this is we checked explicitly by choosing an appropriate representation. So this is OK. And the difficult part will be to choose an operator or construct an operator, M hat, such that it is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So we will have to find an operator M hat which has this property, and we will have to find it in such a way that the classical limit of the M operator does match, or does up to H bar corrections, does reproduce the classical result. Yep. Oh yeah, thank you. So I will start with, in order to derive the operator corresponding to the Marston constraint, I will start with some heuristic considerations. So that you also can see from where the final Marston constraint comes from. So let us write again the formula for M, which is given by d3x c of x squared by the determinant of q of x. And as you can imagine, given the fact that c of x was given by something like trace FAB of X EA EB divided by determinant of E, square root of determinant of E, will face quite hard operator ordering and maybe UV singularity problems when we put operator hats here. So what you have to do, as always in quantum field theory, you have to regularize and then hope to, that you get something which makes sense when you take the regulator away. And I will use here a very simple point splitting regularization. I will write this as limit as epsilon goes to 0. This expression, let me write it first and then I explain. Chi epsilon of x and y, c of x, c of y, divided by v epsilon x 1/2, v epsilon y 1/2. So I need to define what is chi epsilon of x and y. Well, it's, in a sense, it's a regularization of the delta distribution. So I choose some coordinates, and I define chi epsilon of x and y to be product 1, 2, 3, theta of epsilon 1/2 minus xA minus yA. So this is just the Heaviside function, and epsilon is some small parameter epsilon. Now, limit as epsilon goes to 0 of this object divided by epsilon cubed is the delta distribution. So you will ask where's the epsilon cubed here in this expression. It sits in this function here. V epsilon x is the same as d3x chi epsilon, y chi epsilon of x and y square root of that e. And here I've used the fact that, as before, that q is the same as absolute value of that e. So if you look at this, then it's very easy to see that in the limit as epsilon goes to 0, you recover this expression here. OK. Now let us continue. So what I'm doing here is a well-known procedure in quantum field theory, a regularization procedure, which is called point splitting. So now let us look at so m can be written as limit epsilon goes to 0 of, let us first consider something else before we continue with this formula. C of x was given by trace FAB EA EB by that E. Now, there's a nice Poisson bracket identity which we use. And this identity and generalizations thereof will be very important also in the truncation of loop quantum gravity, which is called loop quantum cosmology. And all these nice results that have been obtained by Martin Borywald and collaborators, and lately by Ashlika Singh and Pavlovsky, are all based, or some parts of it are based on this kind of identity, which is the following. If you compute the Poisson bracket between AA and V epsilon of x, then you recover exactly this expression which is sitting here in this part of the Hamiltonian constraint. In fact, you can actually show, maybe this is also good to know, that this green object is nothing else than the Kohl triad. So this is exactly EA J of X. And I'm dropping for the discussion here, I'm dropping factors of 16 pi G because I will get confused. You can put them in as you like. Pardon me? Where's an epsilon? I don't see any epsilon.
It's on the left part, inside the front.
No, that's the, this epsilon?
No, this one. No, I just, so it's just about that formula inside the green.
Oh, yeah, you're right. So it's C. Oops, green. Epsilon ABC. That's two. So using this, you can.
The Poisson bracket on the right hand side, the epsilon dependence goes away.
Goes away. Mm-hmm. It's because this function, when you equate x and y, it's unity. That's why. So let's continue with the master constraint. So m can be written as limit as epsilon goes to 0 of trace f veg a comma so what I will also make use of is the fact that here in the if I divide this Poisson bracket identity by the square root of this kind of volume functional here. Then I get 2 times this. So modulo factors of 2 and 16 pi g, I get the following relation, chi epsilon x and y trace f wedge a v epsilon 1/2. So this point here, this dot here, is in order to denote the fact that this square root of the volume depends on this argument x here, and here on the argument y, so that we don't forget about it. So this this differential form notation comes from the fact that we have indeed there's this epsilon abc here. So there's this formula for that now expresses everything in terms of the curvature, the connection, the Poisson bracket, and the volume. And the purpose of writing it like this was that we do have a nice quantization of the volume operator, which was a positive self-adjoint operator, so it makes sense to take the square root of this operator. So if you can make sense out of this expression involving the holonomy of the connection along, if you can somehow write this expression at least when we take a limit in terms of holonomies, which we also know how to quantize, then we can actually make sense out of this expression. So now, yeah?
This is one expression?
So this is
the relation between those two lines?
So this is, so I have limited space on the blackboard, but this is the same double integral that I had here. So there's this x integral, and then there's a y integral. You don't see the integration because we have written this in terms of forms. So this is, if you want
the
this.
The limit applies to both.
Limit applies to both, yeah. So now we make use of another nice observation, namely, let us take a path like this and compute the Poisson bracket between the holonomy along this path with say with b epsilon to 1/2. Then it's not difficult to see that this becomes, and we choose again paths very short and very in coordinates such that the beginning point of this pass has parameter value 0 and the end point has parameter value epsilon, then this is given by a Ej of E, not the beginning point of the pass, E epsilon 1/2 times Ea dot of 0 times epsilon times tau j, where these are the generators of SU2, plus higher order corrections. Similarly, if you have a loop like this, maybe, which has a starting point here, it goes an epsilon parameter distance here along some vector u, and comes back along another path, and here's also parameter value epsilon along another path with vector field v, then you can show that, and this is my loop alpha, then A of alpha v epsilon 1/2 is given by epsilon squared ua vb fab of this beginning point here, let me call it p, b j v epsilon 1/2 and tau j. This is nothing, I mean, you know this, this formula you know in principle, this is nothing else than the Stokes theorem or the non-abelian generalization thereof. So now the idea is to replace in these formulas the occurrence of F and A by holonomies and long edges or loops. And then I will stop for today. So what I do, I choose a partition of sigma, let's call it p epsilon of sigma into boxes of parameter volume epsilon cubed. Then I can write this double integral as a double Riemann sum in the following way. Sum over boxes, box prime in P epsilon, chi epsilon of V box prime, C tilde of box, C tilde box prime. And where V box is some point in box, and C tilde of box can now be written in the following way. Here I'm, for simplicity and for reasons of illustration, I'm choosing the boxes to be actually tetrahedra. So maybe I should have written this here in terms of triangles and rather than boxes. So let's do it like this. Into tetrahedra of So each tetrahedron has the starting point, V box, and three outgoing edges here, EI box, EJ box, EK box. And then it's not difficult to verify that the following is true, epsilon IJK trace A of alpha IJ of delta, A of EK of delta times Poisson bracket AEK of delta to the minus 1 V epsilon V box. So the meaning of all of this is that we have regularized everything now in terms of things that we can quantize. The Poisson bracket will be quantized by replacing it by a commutator divided by I times H bar. And this whole thing is a Riemann sum approximation to this continuum integral. And I will continue with this expression tomorrow. Thank you. Actually, this is a good question. One could have treated the spatial diffeomorphism constraint also by absorbing it into a more complicated master constraint. It's at the moment it's more for practical reasons because we already have a nice solution of the spatial diffeomorphism constraint in terms of this more traditional formulation. But there's a generalization of this also involving the spatial diffeomorphism constraint inside the master constraint. And if you think about it, this works is actually quite astonishing or unexpected because I would have to include an expression of the form so I call this sometimes extended master constraint because it's M plus D3X QAB CA CB divided by the square root of that Q. So it involves the infinitesimal generator of spatial diffeomorphisms, which I just told you cannot be quantized. It doesn't exist. But the miracle is that this object can be quantized. So compound operators sometimes exist even if the components don't exist.